Court is ready to hear oral argument.
Bind causes of Pamela Chambers Gorman versus Life Insurance Company in North America and J.C. Cathy versus Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. We have allocated you as petitioners and respondents 30 minutes for petitioners, 40 minutes for respondents, and 10 minutes for rebuttal. And the court is ready to hear oral argument.
I represent Pamela Chambers Gorman, and the court has expressed an interest in two of the issues in my application, both of which are procedural issues having to do with when ERISA has to be raised in order for a defendant to rely on ERISA. The first issue concerns whether it has to be pleaded under Rule 94, and the second issue concerns if it doesn't have to be pleaded, does it at least have to be raised in some manner in the trial court, and did Lina raise it in an appropriate manner in the trial court? I believe the first issue can be broken down into two sub-issues. The first one is whether this is something that would ordinarily need to be pleaded under Rule 94, and the second one is, if ordinarily it would need to be pleaded, is there some federal reason which supersedes Rule 94 and prevents this from needing to be pleaded in the specific case? Whether it needs to be pleaded, in my view, that's a very easy question. ERISA preemption is not something that denies or rebuts one of the elements of plaintiff's case. Instead, it's clearly an avoidance or an affirmative defense. It's something that says, so what? You've proved your case. You still can't win because there's this federal law over there which says something else. Under the policy that the court established in the City of San Antonio case, which held that government immunity had to be pleaded, clearly the type of, which is kind of a brand of immunity we have here, that you can't get to me because you have to go under this federal statute and your ordinary state common law statute doesn't apply, is an avoidance or an affirmative defense. And also, clearly, it's something that...
Well, we don't have any federal motions involved in the City of San Antonio versus Davis. That was a judgment the court made just based solely on Texas law.
Right. That pertains to my second sub-issue, which is whether there's some federal reason which defeats the ordinary interpretation of Rule 94. Now, turn to that issue, and I think on the federal issue, the Court of Appeals went astray in two ways. The first way in which they went astray was they misread the ERISA statute. The way in which they misread the ERISA statute was that they failed to draw the distinction between the portion of the statute which gives federal courts exclusive jurisdiction over certain causes of action, and where it says a federal court has exclusive jurisdiction of causes of action brought, quote, under, unquote, ERISA, and the part of the ERISA statute which says that ERISA preempts causes of action which, quote, relate to an employee benefit plan, unquote. There is a vast difference between the exclusive jurisdiction of certain, not all, but certain causes of action under ERISA and the broad, much broader preemption of anything that relates to an employee benefit plan. The Court of Appeals kind of mixed up the two and concluded that ERISA somehow gives the federal court's exclusive jurisdiction of anything that relates to an employee benefit plan, when that's not what the statute says. It says the federal court has exclusive jurisdiction of certain and not all causes of action brought under ERISA. This word under is very important because there's a line of federal law going back into the 19th century, which interprets what Congress must be saying when they say that a cause of action is brought under a statute. This line of authority interprets what arising under federal law means for purposes of federal question jurisdiction, and the line of authority clearly holds that in order to be brought under federal law, the federal statute must provide an essential element of the cause of action. If you read the ERISA statute, there are only a certain limited number of causes of action which ERISA, the statute itself, creates. Here, the only cause of action that we brought that is even arguably under ERISA is the cause of action on the insurance policy. And that happens to be the cause of action that Congress has put within the joint jurisdiction of both the state and the federal courts. Our bad faith cause of action is not brought under ERISA. It's brought under Texas common law. The ERISA statute doesn't provide any cause of action to a plaintiff for bad faith. This cause of action, be it preempted or be it not, is not one brought under ERISA, which would be within the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal courts. Likewise, the suit against Tenneco is a common law suit for trying to establish that a fiduciary duty was owed and owed to Pamela Gorman and that it was breached. This cause of action also is not brought under ERISA. It may or may not be preempted by ERISA. It may or may not relate to an employee benefit package. That's not the initial issue. It was not brought under ERISA, therefore it is not within the exclusive jurisdiction of the federal court. And I think the Court of Appeals went astray here by completely confusing causes of action brought under ERISA with causes of action which may relate to an employee benefit package. Now, Tenneco has argued that, wait a minute, ERISA does give a cause of action for breach of fiduciary duties, and this cause, therefore, your cause against us is under ERISA and within the exclusive jurisdiction. But I think they're confusing the issue in two ways. In the first place, the cause of action provided by ERISA for breach of fiduciary duties is a cause of action for the benefit of the employee benefit plan itself, which ERISA turns into a legal entity. Under ERISA, a beneficiary, the Secretary of the Treasury, or any of a list of people can bring an action against the ERISA trustee, but any money recovered goes into the plan. It's not ERISA doesn't provide any cause of action for breach of fiduciary duties to the beneficiary as a beneficiary. And the second way in which Tenneco's argument goes astray is that there's no evidence in this record that Tenneco was an ERISA fiduciary. It's very important to realize that an employer as such, in his capacity as an employer, is not necessarily an ERISA fiduciary under the ERISA statute. There are two types of fiduciaries. There are trustees who are supposed to manage the assets, and administrators who are involved in filing reports and determining who gets benefits. Now, the statute provides that the employer becomes the administrator by default if the employer fails to appoint an administrator, but the only evidence I can find in this record on who is the administrator says that somebody called the Tenneco Benefits Committee, a group of individuals who are not identified in the record, is the administrator. If Tenneco is saying that it is an ERISA fiduciary and therefore immune, this is something they had to prove in the trial court, and there's no evidence whatsoever on who the identity of the administrators are or who are the trustees under the plan. The second way in which I feel that the Court of Appeals went astray in its opinion was that they completely misread and misconstrued this International Longshoremen's case from the United States Supreme Court. That, the holding of that case is a very, very narrow one. It holds that one specific type of preemption created by the National Labor Relations Act, which the labor lawyers call Garmon preemption, is jurisdictional. And the reason they held that were complex policy reasons, because they felt that Congress had said that all disputes of this particular nature must go to the National Labor Relations Board and not to any court, state or federal. Now, the lower federal courts have somewhat expanded this holding and say that preemption is jurisdictional if it speaks to the choice of forum rather than the choice of what law governs the action. But those same lower federal courts have also held, both the Fifth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit and dicta from the Eleventh Circuit, that ERISA preemption, when you have an individual suing for bad faith or something on an insurance policy, goes to the choice of law and not to the choice of forum, and that therefore this preemption is not jurisdictional. And both the Fifth and the Ninth Circuit, who are supposed to be experts in federal law, have explicitly held that it has to be pleaded as an affirmative defense. And they're operating Federal Rule 8 is worded identically with Texas Rule 94. The Texas lower courts have also gradually come to the same conclusion that it must be pleaded as an affirmative defense. And here we have an interesting pattern developing. The Dallas Court of Appeals, in its first case on this subject, in a footnote said that ERISA was jurisdictional, although it didn't make a lot of difference because it determined whether the case was dismissed rather than reversed and rendered. But then, more recently, this spring, the Dallas Court of Appeals has reconsidered its position and now has held that ERISA preemption is an affirmative defense that must be pleaded. The same thing with the Houston Court of Appeals. In my case, they held it was jurisdictional. You don't have to plead it. And in a more recent case, which I called to the court's attention, the Houston Court of Appeals has changed its mind and said that ERISA preemption is an affirmative defense that must be pleaded. This, and as a matter of policy, I would suggest that unless the federal law just absolutely requires that this not be an affirmative defense, it ought to be an affirmative defense, because the purpose of the Rule 94 is to prevent trial by ambush, or in this case, an appeal by ambush. The plaintiffs had no notice until they walked into the court the first day of trial that anybody was going to rely on this extremely complicated federal law that was out there. It's very difficult to expect the plaintiff's attorney, who was basically a state lawyer, to be up on this federal law, and it's something that the defendant ought to at least have to give notice in its pleadings that this is what I'm going to rely on to defeat your cause of action. And it also gives the plaintiff, if he gets that notice, the plaintiff may want to reconsider and non-suit and file in federal court or something. This is clearly an avoidance or an affirmative defense because it doesn't rebut part of his cause of action. Okay, the second issue that you've expressed interest in granting the application for writ of error is whether Lina properly presented its ERISA defense, if it had one. Neither party pleaded ERISA. Tenneco in the trial court at least moved for a directed verdict based on ERISA and then moved for judgment NOV based on ERISA. Lina never alleged in the trial court that the bad faith cause of action was preempted. Never alleged, I didn't even dream in the trial court, that the plain old cause of action based on a life insurance policy was preempted. The only thing they said was preempted at any time to the trial court was one small part of our pleadings that claimed there were misrepresentations in the summary plan description. The parts that they said were preempted were never even presented to the jury. So at a minimum, even if it isn't an affirmative defense, it still is something that has to be presented with a proper objection to the trial court, which Lina never did on the main causes of action for bad faith and breach of contract. Unless there are any questions, that's all I had to say.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court that Martin Kay will continue argument for the petition.
Justices, before I begin, I'd like to introduce my co-counsel, Joe Longley, and then our co-counsel, Mr. John Patterson and James Patterson. The court's familiar from our briefing with the individual facts of this case and how important this is to the Cathys and the condition Ms. Cathy is in based on the summary judgment evidence. I think the court's also aware of the importance of this legal issue in the broader context, because by some estimates, half of the workers in America, half the workers in the state of Texas, are covered under ERISA plans through their employers. And that number is actually larger than it sounds, because the half that are not covered include those that have no insurance, those that have no employment. Your decision today is either going to mark a massive transfer of power and authority from the state level to the federal level, or it is going to affirm what we respectfully submit is the traditional, historical, federal and state policy of leaving regulation of the business of insurance to states, a policy...
Well, to be fair, that decision has been made by Congress, and our job is just to decide...
Exactly, Your Honor.
...correctly what decision they've made.
That's it, exactly. The key issue, I believe, in this case, we've argued a number of things in the briefs. I simply submit the briefs on many of these more minor issues. In my view, the key issue before you is whether Article 2121 of the Texas Insurance Code is saved under the explicit language of ERISA from preemption by ERISA. We submit that nothing could more clearly be a law regulating the business of insurance, which the Congress of the United States explicitly saved from preemption by its own enactment. If Article 2121 doesn't qualify, it's hard to imagine what does. It's hard to imagine how Congress could have been more clear.
In order to qualify, does it have to satisfy the three-pronged Apparent-Ferguson Act test?
Yes, sir, I believe it does. And I believe it does have to satisfy the test, and it does satisfy the test. The McCarran-Ferguson test that's been elaborated, well, an example is in Pilot Life versus Dedoe. The Supreme Court first applies a common sense view of whether the law applies to the business of insurance, and obviously Article 2121 applies to the business of insurance. Claims handling, the fact that you have a claim is what insurance is all about. If you had no coverage, no claim, there would be no insurance. That's the essence of the insurance relationship. Then the three factors are whether the practice involves a transfer of risk. Paying or not paying a claim is entirely what transference of risk is all about. Whether a particular claim is covered or not covered at the most basic and fundamental level involves transference of risk. That's what the policy involves. Is this loss going to be transferred from this individual to this insurer? Yes or no? So it qualifies under that prong. The second prong is whether it's limited to companies in the business of insurance, whether it's limited to the insurance industry. And payment of claims, again, is what defines insurance. By definition, it's limited to insurers. But for the payment of claims, but for the issuance of coverage or potential coverage, there would not be an insurance relationship. The third prong is whether the statute is directed specifically to the insurance industry, and obviously 2121 is.
Do the second and third prong suggest that the Deceptive Trade Practices Act is preempted?
Your Honor, I think for the most part, the DTPA probably is preempted. The part of the DTPA that is not is section 1750A4, and basically it's just a tag-along provision of the insurance code. If Article 2121 is saved, then this one portion of the DTPA, which only incorporates unfair insurance practice under 2121, must also be saved. There's really no functional difference between the two, which I think this court recognized in Vail. There are different standing requirements, but as far as being directed to the insurance industry, that part of the DTPA, which of course was a companion to Article 2121, qualifies if Article 2121 qualifies.
If the DTPA just said this applies to all, anybody deals with a consumer, probably including insurance companies, and it wasn't over a separate section in the insurance code, would that make any difference, or could you still apply this kind of practical analysis to say the DTPA as it related to insurance companies?
If it wasn't for that one part of the DTPA that specifically incorporates the insurance code provisions, I don't think the DTPA could necessarily be saved under the savings clause. Pilot Life versus Dedeaux, when it said the common law duty of good faith and fair dealing under Mississippi law was preempted and not saved, I think that analysis would get rid of the common law claims and probably the general DTPA claims. It's only the insurance-specific portion. And if that portion purported to incorporate other general duties, I think that would create a problem. Fortunately, the way the statute's drafted, it only incorporates what we contend is saved under Article 2121.
If Article 2121 is not preempted,
yes, sir.
Why would anybody bring suit under ERISA rather than Article 2121?
To get at benefits that were available under the plan itself. I view this a lot like workers' compensation, where you're given a specific remedy against a specific entity. It's a lesser remedy than you had at common law. It's a lesser remedy than that you may have under other statutes. But in workers' comp, as to the employer, you have this specific remedy, and that's what you seek. Under ERISA, as to the plan, you have this specific remedy for benefits under these federal standards that you're entitled to. I think the analogy continues, just as under workers' comp, if a bad product hurts the worker, you can bring in the product manufacturer and have all your common law and statutory remedies. If someone other than the plan does something wrong, if they make misrepresentations, false statements, if they engage in tortious conduct, you're entitled to sue that entity for other damages under other theories. We couldn't sue the employer for benefits under the plan because he's not obligated to pay them. That's, I think, the distinction.
And so if you're entitled to benefits from the plan and the plan says, but we're just not going to give them to you, then you'd sue under ERISA.
Yes, sir.
But for misrepresentations and bad faith conduct and fraudulent, willful sort of behavior, you would still sue under Article 21.
Yes, sir, as to other parties.
And none of that would be preempted.
Yes, sir. And I think that interpretation is borne out by the preemption, savings, and deemer clauses. The savings clause in Metropolitan versus Massachusetts, the U.S. Supreme Court emphasized the importance of the savings clause. They said its function, in light of the preemption clause, was to save an entire area of law from preemption, that area being state regulation of insurance. Then you have the deemer clause that says, despite what we said in the savings clause, you cannot deem a plan to be in the business of insurance. That, I think, puts the exclusive remedy as to the plan back under ERISA.
But even without ERISA, had ERISA never been passed, if an insurance plan refused to pay benefits that the covered insured was entitled to, he certainly could bring some sort of state action to recover those benefits.
Yes, sir. But for ERISA, I think that'd be insurance. And I think that's why Congress said you can't characterize that as insurance, because they didn't want state regulation.
So what has ERISA done that wasn't done before?
What ERISA,
under your theory?
What ERISA has done with respect to insurance benefits and benefits under a plan, it's limited what you can get from the paying entity, the plan. It's limited your remedies against that entity. And that's one point we make in the briefing, that the plan is a separate entity that can sue and be sued. It has an existence of its own. It's created a remedy and limited that remedy. it's done nothing as to other parties who engage in wrongful and tortious conduct, and certainly has done nothing as to insurance companies that engage in wrongful insurance practice. I think there's an important distinction to be kept in mind. ERISA also applies to pension benefits. Before ERISA, there was no effective state or federal regulation of pension benefits. In that context, this broad preemption of state laws makes sense because Congress was coming in giving a remedy, giving regulation where there was a vacuum as to pension and retirement benefits that had been misspent and squandered. As to insurance benefits, which are also included, there was no vacuum of state regulation. We've laid out the history for you. Since 1869, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that as a traditional area of state regulation. The only time that was ever questioned was in 1944 when the U.S. Supreme Court came out with a decision that for the first time recognized that insurance does affect commerce. That caused great concern that at that point the federal government was going to enter into this area of traditional state regulation. Congress immediately in 1945 passed the McCarran-Ferguson Act to maintain the status quo. The introductory language of McCarran-Ferguson says state regulation of insurance is in the public interest. No federal law shall invalidate state laws regulating the business of insurance. The appendix we filed with you this week, Article 2121, Section 1, accepts explicitly, by an explicit citation to McCarran-Ferguson, the federal invitation to continue state regulation. It says, under McCarran-Ferguson, we adopt Article 2121 to fulfill our role as a state regulating insurance. The only thing the defendants in this case have presented to change this historical status quo is ERISA itself, when ERISA itself says not once but twice in the Savings Clause, it says we save from preemption laws regulating the business of insurance. And the second place is Section 1144D, which is also cited in the materials and included in your appendix. That says that ERISA shall not be construed to supersede or affect any federal law. If you allow ERISA to preempt Article 2121, I respectfully submit that violates the Savings Clause and it violates McCarran-Ferguson. The real argument the defendants have is Pilot Life versus Dedoe. There's broad sweeping language in the second part of that opinion that if you took that, if you had nothing else to consider, you could say, yes, you know, it broadly preempts, it's an inconsistent remedy, we're going to take it away and wipe the field clean for federal regulation. But you're not writing on a clean slate. You are writing in the context of an explicit command from Congress in McCarran-Ferguson, an explicit command from Congress in the Savings Clause that you're as bound under the Supremacy Clause to follow as you are to follow Pilot Life versus Dedoe.
What do we do about Justice O'Connor's broad language in the second part of Pilot Life?
You do what courts always do, and that is try to find a way to harmonize the two. If you read Pilot Life as broadly as they contend it should be read, that means that the United States Supreme Court ignored the Savings Clause without expressly saying that they could not harmonize it. If the Supreme Court wants to say that the conflict between the Preemption and Savings Clause is so great that they have to read one out of the statute in order to enforce the other, let them say that.
They could also harmonize it by reading 2121, by giving it a less expansive breadth as far as being regulation of insurance. Let's say that private regulation, for instance, is never contemplated.
Yes, you could, but I don't believe there's any real legal authority for reading 2121 narrowly. It says what it says.
The introductory language there says that all of 2121 is passed.
Yes, sir.
For in as the states are regulated.
Yes, sir. I think the state giving a private cause of action, you know, under the private attorney general theory is a valid state regulation of insurance. How they choose to do it, whether through public enforcement or allowing private enforcement, doesn't change the fact that they are regulating insurance.
Patrick.
has any state Supreme Court or federal appeals court accepted your position?
Your Honor, there are two cases cited by the defendants that I think actually help us three-quarters of the way, just like the Cathy opinion does. They go so far as to hold that a statute, the California Unfair Practice Statute, appears to be saved as a law regulating insurance. They accept this broad view of pilot line. That's Cann versus Connecticut General. I think they're right in holding that the statute would be saved. I think that court erred in reading pilot life too broadly for the reasons I've argued. The other case is a state court decision out of California. It's, I believe the cite to it is Colonial, which is cited in the defendant's material. It's Commercial Life versus Superior Court. In that case, the California Supreme Court again adopted the reasoning of Cann to the point of saying that their unfair insurance practice statute would appear to be saved, adopted the reasoning of Cann, and said nevertheless it would be preempted under this broad language. What I'd like to refer you to in that opinion is the dissent. Two justices dissenting say that Cann has gone too far, that this does mark a massive transfer of power from the state to the federal level, despite Congress saying this area should be saved to the states. Other than that, I'm not aware of any court that's accepted our position except Mayfield versus Hartford, which is the opinion out of Judge Nallen's court, federal court, holding in about three paragraphs that 2121 is saved from preemption.
But there are a number of federal appeals court decisions on this subject, while they don't involve our statute, are against you.
Yes, sir. Another one is the Ann Schultz opinion, which I think is out of the Fourth Circuit. It follows the same path as Cann, and that is find the statute would apparently be saved. I contend that once you find it saved, pilot life cannot stand for the proposition that it's nevertheless preempted. Pilot life, I think, has to be read for what it was, a case involving a common law cause of action that wasn't entitled to being saved as a law regulating insurance. If you don't read pilot life in the context of its facts, it's in irreconcilable conflict with the express language of Congress that they were purporting to construe. I recognize those cases are against us, and I respectfully submit they're just wrong. Thank you, Justice.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr.
May it please the Court, Mr. A.J. Harper, Mr. James Landon, Ms. Claudia Wilson-Frost, Ms. Jennifer Briggs-Hogan will present arguments for respondents. Mr. Harper will open.
May it please the Court, appearing on behalf of Dow Chemical Company, who is the plan sponsor and administrator in the Cathy case. First, I want to direct the Court's attention to one of the arguments made by Mr. Kincaid, which under the Perino decision of the Supreme Court is simply wrong. The business of insurance is not the claims handling and claims processing. The transfer of risk, the content of the policy decisions, which are the McCarran-Ferguson Act factors, occur at the time the contract is entered into and is not affected by later conduct involving claims handling. What Mr. Kincaid has not argued and has not really addressed is the fact that ERISA preempts any law which relates to or affects or concerns an ERISA plan. In pilot life, a fully insured case, the defendant was the insurance company. In Metropolitan versus Taylor, the defendants were the employer and the insurance company. In both of those cases, the Supreme Court found ERISA preempted causes of action, which included allegations of a misrepresentation by the employer in the Taylor case. If it relates to an ERISA plan, the preemption clause 1144A is applicable. This Court, Names versus Ames, recognize this when it said that any claim that affects the operation or content of an ERISA plan is preempted by ERISA. And what the Court held in Ames was that because the plan had terminated and the monies had been dispersed into a bank account, ERISA was no longer applicable. This Court's decision in McClendon versus Ingersoll Rand also recognizes the preemptive sweep of ERISA. the distinction made by the majority in McClendon is that because the plaintiff there was not seeking benefits under an ERISA plan, a state cause of action could be maintained. Whereas here, benefits are being sought under an ERISA plan. The whole essence of the claim relates to the ERISA plan. Then ERISA preemption applies. Now, I want to turn to the what we were calling.
To do that, as far as your initial comment about the Mr. Kincaid's remarks on the Karen Ferguson three-prong test, you're saying that here the three-prong Karen Ferguson test that the court looked to in Pilot Line is not satisfied.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which prong is not satisfied? Why?
First, there is no transfer of risk, which is the essence of insurance. As this court has held and other courts have held and the Supreme Court recognized, involved in either Article 362 or Article 2121, Section 16, and certainly not in the DPTA.
Well, as it relates to Article 2121, what would be necessary in order to have a transfer of risk?
The transfer of risk occurs when you enter into the contractual relationship. When I go to the insurance company and say, I want you to insure me against this specific risk, and I pay you the premium, then the risk of loss that has been insured is transferred, and that is a completed transaction at that point.
And you say that cannot occur at the time of claims made.
That's my position, and that's what the Supreme Court held in the Perino case.
What about the second and third prongs?
The second prong is that Article 2121 does not affect the content of the policy. And that's what the second prong involves, is the content of the policy. Again, the content of the policy is entered into when the contractual relationship is established and a subsequent dispute as to whether or not a particular loss is or is not within the content of that policy is not the same as the establishment of the content of the policy, which is the second prong of McCarran-Ferguson. And again, that's what the Supreme Court held in Perino and what they reiterated in the Pilot Life.
So is your contention that Article 2121 does not regulate insurance for purposes of saving costs?
Yes, sir.
Despite the purpose set out in Section 1 of Article 2121?
In spite of the purpose set out in Article 2121, Section 1, the savings clause does not save Article 2121, Section 16, or Article 3.62 from ERISA preemption for the simple reason, as the Supreme Court said in Pilot Life, the remedies provided for claims against an ERISA plan, whether the ERISA plan is sued as an entity or whether the plan sponsor and administrator are sued, are exclusive, and the sweep of that preemption is displacing.
Karen Ferguson Act, three prongs are concerned. You say Article 2121, despite its purpose clause, doesn't satisfy any of the three prongs.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And are we bound under Pilot Line by whether or not it satisfies the Karen Ferguson Act, or are we look elsewhere to determine whether this is a statute that regulates insurance?
If I understand your question correctly, I think you're obviously bound under the Supremacy Clause by the Supreme Court's interpretation and reading of ERISA and its provisions and its sweep. As to whether or not Article 2121 being within the insurance code, could somehow be winnowed out, if you will, from under ERISA, I don't think so. I don't think an analysis of the McCarran-Ferguson Act factors as specified in the Pilot Life will allow that result. It doesn't transfer risk. It doesn't specify or dictate the content of the policy. It doesn't meet the McCarran-Ferguson Act factors, even though it may be within the insurance code. And that's what all the courts, the California Supreme Court, the Ninth Circuit, the 11th Circuit, the 8th Circuit, the 10th Circuit have all held.
As to your argument about the conflicting remedies, which I discussed with opposing counsel from Pilot Life, is it your contention or your reading of Pilot Life that any state statute that provides a remedy no matter what it says about the business of insurance, is preempted if that remedy is not 100% the same as the ERISA remedy?
My position, Your Honor, is it does not matter whether it's 100% consistent or whether it's inconsistent. The Supreme Court in Pilot Life and in Metropolitan Life versus Taylor stated that ERISA preemption and the intent of Congress was to preempt all state laws, whether consistent or inconsistent, where a core issue of ERISA, such as the remedial provisions, is implicated. And that's the basis on which they distinguished Metropolitan Life versus Massachusetts.
So what was the purpose of the savings clause then?
Savings clause is to save insurance, as defined by McCarran-Ferguson Act, the traditional role of the states in the regulation of policy contents, for example. It does not, in that context, and as the Supreme Court said in Pilot Life, you have to read that to temper it with the exclusive remedy provisions provided in ERISA for things such as claims handling.
So your understanding of the savings clause is that all that was preserved was the capability of the states to establish the contents of the policy, like whether it be mental health coverage or alcoholism coverage or whatever?
Insofar as there is an insured plan, that's what Metropolitan Life versus Massachusetts held. Insofar as there's a self-insured plan, not even that is saved in terms of dictating to an ERISA plan or to the sponsor of an ERISA plan that they have to provide any sort of mandated benefits.
There's nothing to prevent an employer, I don't know whether Val does it or not, from handling their workers' compensation benefits through ERISA, is there?
There is an exclusion in ERISA related to a workers' compensation benefits. They are not within the definition of an ERISA plan.
Has Judge Brown held in the Gibbs case that an ERISA plan may include workers' compensation benefits?
An ERISA plan can include supplementary benefits to supplement workers' compensation, but it does not displace or implicate the workers' compensation system. So you could have an ERISA plan that would provide supplementary benefits, and that's not at all unusual. But those are not the in place of what's provided by the state workers' compensation laws.
You don't think ERISA preempts if the workers' compensation is provided as a part of an employer plan that it's preempted by ERISA?
If I understand your question, and I'm not sure whether you're agreeing with my distinction between the state workers' compensation law, which provides benefits, state mandated benefits, and an ERISA plan which provides supplementary benefits to the workers' compensation system. Insofar as the ERISA plan provides benefits related to workers' compensation injury, i.e. supplementary benefits, then ERISA would preempt a claim as to those supplementary benefits. It would not preempt a claim under the workers' compensation law per se. Okay, my time has expired, and Mr. Linnigan will now argue on behalf of Metropolitan Life, unless there are any other questions.
Any questions? Thank you,
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, I'm arguing on behalf of Metropolitan Life and Michael Madelin, an individual employee of Metropolitan Life. For the reasons stated by Mr. Harper, I respectfully submit that the Court of Appeals' decision was in line with the other precedents in this area, was correct, and should be upheld. I'd like to make a few additional comments. First, as Mr. Kincaid has acknowledged, the Federal Court of Appeals that ruled on this question, the rule that ERISA preempts state insurance code provisions like 2121, that purport to provide remedies in addition to ERISA 502. The insurance codes that have been preempted under this analysis are those of Virginia, California, Colorado, and Missouri. The Texas cases are also uniform in this regard. Up to this point, with the exception of the Mayfield case. The ERISA 502 remedy is a remedy that was carefully crafted by Congress, as the Supreme Court said in the Massachusetts Mutual case versus Russell. Mr. Kincaid points out ERISA implicates over half the workers in the United States. And ERISA was designed to provide a uniform system of regulation for those workers. With respect to the remedies provision, the 502 provision, Congress established that somebody claiming benefits could recover in a suit under ERISA benefits. They could obtain declaratory relief or injunctive relief, ordering the plan administrator to pay for future benefits. They could obtain attorney's fees. And those were the remedies that were provided by Congress. They're carefully reticulated, as the Supreme Court said in Russell, and are, as the Supreme Court said in MetLife v. Taylor, necessarily federal, and they are exclusive of other state remedies. The analysis of ERISA preemption, I submit, applies to Madeline, the employee, as well as to Metropolitan and Dow. Madeline acted as a claims consultant, making recommendation on the claims on behalf of his employer, Metropolitan. If the ERISA preempts the state law claims against Metropolitan, as the Court of Appeals correctly held, then it also preempts those claims against Madeline. Unless the Court has questions, that's the extent of my submission.
Any questions?
Thank you. Is your position that all that Congress preserved in the state right was to define the terms of the policy?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, and I believe that was the holding in the Metropolitan Life versus Massachusetts case in the insured context. Mandated benefits laws are the classic example of that were preserved by the insurance savings clause. But Congress did not speak on what had to be the content of welfare benefit plans. There was a vacuum there, and the state insurance code then was saved from preemption. In this particular case, Congress did speak on what remedies were allowable in suits involving claims for benefits under ERISA, and they spoke in the form of Section 502. And that's the distinction, really, between Metropolitan Life versus Mass and the broad, sweeping preemption of state law remedies in Pilot Life and Taylor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you, Your Honor.
Good morning. I represent Tenneco, Inc. Tenneco, Inc. is a respondent in the Gorman case with respect to petitioner's appeal from an adverse judgment in the First District Court of Appeals in Houston. Tenneco is also a conditional petitioner in this case, requesting this court to dismiss petitioner's claims against Tenneco for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Both applications have been granted by the court. As the court is aware, this case commenced in the Harris County District Court, 215th Judicial District. It was tried to a jury. At the conclusion of the trial, a jury verdict was entered, and it was a judgment notwithstanding the verdict was entered after that. The judgment notwithstanding the verdict held that petitioners take nothing. Petitioners in this case were the appellants in the Court of Appeals in Houston. They are the applicants here from an adverse judgment reached by the Houston court. As petitioner's counsel has indicated, there are two points of error over which this court has requested argument. Only one point deals with Tenneco, Inc., and that is whether Tenneco, Inc. was obligated to raise ERISA preemption as an affirmative defense in its pleading. Petitioners concede that Tenneco adequately raised ERISA preemption below in the trial court. The Court of Appeals in Houston was not confused insofar as it correctly held that in the ERISA area, the only state claim over which a state court has jurisdiction is a claim for benefits due under ERISA. Petitioners state in their application for writ of error in this court, and I quote, "The suit against Tenneco was not even arguably a suit to recover benefits under an ERISA plan." The Court of Appeals thus should have simply dismissed the petitioner's claims against Tenneco, Inc. for want of subject matter jurisdiction. What the Court of Appeals did was just go one step too far with respect to Tenneco. After correctly concluding that the only cause of action over which the court would have had jurisdiction was a claim for benefits, the court then proceeded to analyze assuming without deciding that petitioners or plaintiffs' pleadings were broad enough to support a claim for benefits under ERISA.
Sure. I'm missing something. You were sued also for breach of contract, common law fraud, breach of fiduciary duty?
No, Your Honor.
You were not joining those causes of action?
No, Your Honor. The only causes of action against Tenneco were for misrepresentation and breach of fiduciary duty. The petitioners abandoned their misrepresentation claims against Tenneco and seek only recovery on their breach of fiduciary duty claims.
Well, there were two breach of fiduciary claims made, breach of fiduciary duty and breach of fiduciary duty. Breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing.
That was as to Lina, Your Honor. The breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing was as to my co-respondent. The only live cause of action that the plaintiffs had or petitioners have against Tenneco was breach of fiduciary duty. When the court, since there were no benefits being made against Tenneco, the court need not have engaged in the analysis of the exercises to whether petitioners adequately raised or conversely waived their ERISA claim in the case. Thus, we're saying that the Court of Appeals, although the result it reached was correct, it went too far in its analysis and should have stopped there. There are two bases for the court's lack of subject matter jurisdiction. One is statutory, and one is by virtue of preemption.
With respect to preemption, the Castillo case casts some doubt on the Gorman's reasoning and conclusion, doesn't it?
The Castillo case does disagree with the Gorman court that raising ERISA preemption is always jurisdictional. Certainly the Castillo decision very ably pointed out how defendants or respondents' conduct in this case, Tenneco included, was the antithesis of waiver. So if it had to be raised, according to Castillo, we raised it adequately to prevent it from being waived and preserved it.
Well, they don't go quite that far. They do say that's a distinguishing feature. They don't talk about the pleading requirement, but doesn't Castillo indicate that the thinking of the Court of Appeals now is that it's never jurisdictional? It's always law selection rather than form selection.
I don't believe that is an accurate view of the law in the country, Your Honor. There are three competing lines of cases in the country, and only one Texas court, Castillo itself, has come right out and said that. There's the Duringer case, which really stands alone in the Fifth Circuit. It holds that on a completely different record than this case, admittedly. No one even mentioned the word ERISA in that case, as far as you can tell from the opinion. Certainly it was mentioned and mentioned and mentioned by Tenneco, as petitioners can see here. In Duringer, under federal law, and on a completely different record, the court did say it should be affirmatively pled. That is the only case that so holds explicitly. Other cases hold that it's always subject matter, a challenge to the court's subject matter jurisdiction, and thus can be raised at any time. There is yet another line of cases, and in fact the line of cases that Duringer purports to rely on don't come right out and ever say you have to plead it affirmatively. Rather, they say it can't be raised for the first time on appeal if it involves choice of law only. In this case, though, Tenneco's raising a risk of preemption on this breach of fiduciary duty claim clearly implicated, if not went directly to, a choice of forum under subject matter.
Couldn't Gorman bring the its claim under ERISA in state court?
A claim for benefits, Your Honor, but they're not seeking one from Tenneco.
But they could not, your position is they could not bring the breach of fiduciary claim anyway, federal court or state.
No, no. They could have brought a breach of fiduciary duty claim against Tenneco in federal court.
Were you the administrator of the plan? Or
Tenneco was the plan sponsor. Tenneco was not the administrator of the plan or the trustee.
And a sponsor is someone who has a fiduciary duty?
The petitioner's argument is that, and I quote from their application, the Tenneco used all of its power and influence to prevent petitioner from obtaining her benefits. Under ERISA, a fiduciary is a person or entity which has discretion and control and exercises discretion and control in the disposition of plan assets, including benefits. It's axiomatic, thus, that if Tenneco did what petitioners contend they did, then Tenneco assumed the duties of an ERISA fiduciary by operation of the statute. So yes, they could have brought a claim in federal court.
So if they'd done that, you wouldn't have tried for a Rule 12b-6 or summary judgment or anything else and said yes, let's go to the merits.
It would depend, Your Honor, on the specific claim they made. In this case, they claim that Tenneco breached its fiduciary duties to the petitioners by the way in which it handled the claim under the plan. I think certainly much more information would be needed to be known about their specific breach of fiduciary duty claim under ERISA to know whether it was cognizable. They didn't bring a cause of action, though, under ERISA. They tried to avoid the preemptive effect of ERISA, but yet all the evidence they introduced at the trial, the entire basis for their fiduciary duty claim over our strenuous objections and our motions for mistrial, directed verdict, and so forth, were premised on ERISA. The court, the petitioners examined our witnesses from ERISA documents, including something called a summary plan description, which itself is mandated by federal law and the Department of Labor regulations. In it, it says an ERISA fiduciary has the following duties to you beneficiaries. And they had our witnesses up there reading that to the jury and asking them whether Tenneco complied with those duties. It is an inescapable conclusion that the cause of action they tried against Tenneco was not for a common law breach of fiduciary duty, but clearly one predicated on ERISA documents, ERISA language, and ERISA testimony. Furthermore, the actual...
And wasn't your defense, what gets lost in all this fight about choice of law and choice of form is the fact that you defended on the basis that Mr. Gorman was not traveling in Tenneco's business?
Yes, we did.
That was your defense?
Yes.
And the jury held against you?
They did.
That just somehow lost in the shuffle here.
Well, Your Honor, that we had no choice but to defend on the merits. We raised ERISA preemption from the first day of trial repeatedly. We raised it, we asserted on those first days that Tenneco asserts that if it was a fiduciary and had duties as a fiduciary, those duties and that statute, that status could only arise under ERISA. We objected to all the admission into evidence of ERISA evidence. We moved to strike question and answers based on ERISA.
If you hadn't done all those things, would you be able to make this complaint for the first time on appeal about ERISA preemption?
With respect to pure preemption, no. Probably not. I think that with respect to a pure preemption claim, if it implicates jurisdiction, or if it, then yes, you can raise it any time. This one did. I think that clearly on this record, there's no problem whatsoever with the adequacy of its having been raised. I think that probably a more correct statement of the law would be in general application that if ERISA preempts, the only jurisdiction a state court has is the concurrent jurisdiction over a claim for benefits. And whether you want to raise that as to whether you want to go to federal court or state court or what have you, then you need to raise that claim below. But otherwise, no, you can raise it up here. Even if the ERISA statute providing for exclusive federal jurisdiction over petitioners' claims against Tenneco were not involved, the same result should obtain on this record. By raising ERISA, and this may address your question, there was no fact issue in this case raised by our raising ERISA preemption. It was merely a question of law. That it was an ERISA plan was clearly undisputed by anybody. In fact, the petitioners introduced abundant evidence of the fact that it was an ERISA plan through that evidence I mentioned before. Petitioners now say that we should have pleaded it as an affirmative defense and have waived it. Well, if that's what they say now, why did they not say that then? When they knew it was ERISA from the first day we mentioned it. We moved for mistrial based on it. We moved for directed verdict based on it. We moved for JNOV and got it, arguably based on it. And never did they ever mention a lack of pleading basis to support that claim. The issue of ERISA preemption was in this case by consent. Every time we raised it, they disavowed it.
Counsel, is it correct that you never mentioned this
question of preemption. Can you please?
Correct. In our answer, correct.
So the first time you informed counsel was the day of, no pretrial, the day of trial?
It was the pretrial prior to trial, that day, yes.
That day, before
yes.
the trial?
Mm-hmm.
So you think you blindsided counsel?
No, I don't. Your Honor, I don't think we've blindsided it. It's our position. It's not a defense. It is, in this instance, was merely telling the court what law applied in the case. It was that this is a question of federal law. This is the law that should apply in the case. And petitioners knew that it was an ERISA plan. Petitioners had known that. The client had the ERISA documents. They had ERISA discovery.
Did you file a motion to move to the federal court?
No, we couldn't at the time, Your Honor. Well, we could have, but it would probably have been remanded at that point. The Supreme Court cases on the well-pleaded complaint rule weren't with us yet. And so there was an impediment to removal at the time because the courts had not come out with the clear holdings they have now that the well-pleaded complaint rule is obviated by virtue of the broad and expansive scope of a risk preemption. And there was contrary law in the Fifth Circuit at that time.
How is your claim of ERISA preemption any different from a claim of illegality or statute of limitations or statute of frauds or other matters covered by Rule 94?
This is quite different because of the effect of federal law in the area, Your Honor. Federal Congress has, by virtue of the Supremacy Clause and also by virtue of the pervasive federal scheme here, Congress has said there are only certain causes of action which state courts can have, and that is concurrent jurisdiction over a claim for benefits.
You think Congress was so eager to restrict state rights when they passed this act that they intended to preclude state court procedure of fair notice in advance of trial through proper pleadings?
Your Honor, I believe that state court procedures cannot be utilized to confer jurisdiction over in state court where it's otherwise lacking by virtue of federal law. So to the extent that this area is so pervasively federal, that I think that they believed, as in other instances under the Supremacy Clause, that state jurisdiction would yield when it should in procedure as well. Unless there are any other questions, my time is up.
Thank you, Kim.
May it please the Court, Jennifer
Brooks
Hogan will continue
by Mr. Your Honor, I want to make it very clear to you that our position in this case is clearly that ERISA preemption is a jurisdictional plea. I don't want to leave any doubt about that being our position, and that as a jurisdictional plea, it can be raised at any time. It could be raised for the first time in this court, having never been mentioned before. I think that there are a number of cases out there, 7 courts in different jurisdictions, as a matter of fact, which have accepted that argument and have held that ERISA preemption is jurisdictional. You don't go beyond that other than to say that it is jurisdictional. It can be raised at any time. It cannot be waived.
Regardless of the nature of the claim?
Regardless of the nature of the claim.
So even if the claim could have been brought in state court, it's still jurisdictional?
Yes, sir. And the reason for that is because ERISA has taken away, it entirely displaces state law causes of action. What exists under ERISA and what state courts are given concurrent jurisdiction to hear is a claim for benefits brought pursuant to that federal statute. It is not a claim under state law. The state courts don't have jurisdiction over a breach of contract claim. They do not have jurisdiction over any state law claims. ERISA has done away with those. It has displaced them completely. And those claims have been replaced and made into federal causes of action, those that the federal court allows under the ERISA statute.
You disagree with your co-counsel on that issue?
I don't think that she said it exactly as I would say it. From my discussions with her earlier, I would say that they were of the same opinion. But if she says that all it takes, that the only jurisdictional issue under ERISA preemption is if there is no concurrent jurisdiction or something of that nature, then yes, sir, I disagree with her. And I think that the case law from the Supreme Court on down supports my position on that.
Your position is you can try one of these cases through on benefits, never raise the issue at any stage of the trial court, appeal it, never raise it at any stage in the Court of Appeals, and come to this court and say you're out of luck.
Yes, sir. And I think that this court has said that in other cases, because if it is jurisdictional, then a jurisdictional argument can be raised at any time. And it's not considered sandbagging, Your Honor, and I want to get to that a little later, too. But it is not sandbagging because the parties cannot confer jurisdiction. And it's not right to suggest that the burden is on the defendant to say, court, you don't have jurisdiction, any more than it is on the plaintiff to say, court, you don't have jurisdiction. And that's the distinction in this case. If it is jurisdictional, it can be raised at any time.
Well,
and I think
you're trying to say, court, you do have jurisdiction when they file their lawsuit?
I think that there is at least one court that has somewhat addressed that issue under ERISA, and that's Cadillac Insurance versus LPC. And that's the San Antonio Court of Appeals. And they held in that court that you were not, there was not enough evidence on the face of the pleading to confer jurisdiction, that ERISA required more on the face of the pleading to go forward. But in any event, Your Honor, I think that what happens is that it doesn't make a difference, really. That's what it comes down to. Because if it is jurisdiction, this court has held, and every court in the country ever faced with a jurisdictional question has held, that a question of jurisdiction can be raised at any time. I want to make sure, though, that the court understands that if it is jurisdictional, that it certainly can be raised at any time. The only courts which have held that ERISA preemption is not jurisdictional in all circumstances have held that ERISA preemption is jurisdictional in at least some circumstances. And it is jurisdictional in those cases where it involves a choice of forum. That's the only two lines of authority which actually exist. Nothing further. Mr. Handy's argument that somehow you look at whether the case arises under ERISA or whether it only relates to, there's simply no authority which backs him up. He can't point to a case which suggests that. The only other authority which exists in this country, other than those courts which have strictly held that ERISA preemption is jurisdictional, are those courts which deal with it on a choice of law, choice of forum analysis. And I'll tell you that in this case, it was clearly a choice of forum analysis. The only claims over which a state court is given jurisdiction under ERISA are claims for benefits due. That is the extent of concurrent jurisdiction. There is no further jurisdiction in the trial court. As far as claims for punitive damages, claims for treble damages, claims for mental anguish damages, claims for pain and suffering, there is no jurisdiction, and it is a choice of forum. If the plaintiffs or the petitioners are going to be entitled to those types of remedies, jurisdiction is vested exclusively in the federal courts, and ERISA states that. And no court anywhere has held that those types of claims can be brought in a state court and that the state court would have jurisdiction over them and that that is a choice of law distinction. Duringer, the Ninth Circuit cases, they were already in federal court and they said, recharacterize those claims as they would be done under ERISA and you're still in federal court. You can't do that when you're in a state court. You recharacterize those claims, the state court does not have jurisdiction, and that's what you look to, is the recharacterized claim. Those claims had to be brought in federal court. That claim of preemption can be raised at any time under any court's holding that has written on ERISA preemption. I want to move quickly just to the idea that ERISA preemption was raised by Lina in the trial court, and I think that goes to the idea of the defendant somehow being in the inequitable position in this case. To me, Judge Gonzalez, it's the same thing as if we as the defendants had gone forward and at the time of trial said, Your Honor, they don't have a product case against us. They can't make a product case against us. They don't have a product case. And the plaintiff stood up and said, Your Honor, we're not making a product case. We're only going to go on negligence, nothing else. And we go along and they introduce some evidence relating to a product liability claim and we say, Your Honor, they can't introduce this evidence. It's not a product case. They say, we're not introducing this on a products case. We're introducing this on negligence. We move for a mistrial, and we say, Your Honor, they're trying to make a products case. They've already abandoned a products case. And we go forward from there. And once again, what they come back with now is to say to us, well, you didn't object. You didn't ask for a directed verdict on the fact that we weren't making a products case after we expressly abandoned it. And then they go on and they say, you didn't object to the issues we submitted on the basis that those issues were not a proper submission of a products case. So at this point in time, we're still able to look back from the Court of Appeals standpoint at the record in the case and suggests that we actually pled and proved and are entitled to judgment on a products case. And that's the same thing that happened in this case. We said, Your Honor, they can't continue in the trial of this case on ERISA preemption. They said, we're not making an ERISA claim. We don't have anything to do with ERISA. We went forward. There are 16 pages in the first approximately 50 pages of the statement of fact that are devoted to discussion of ERISA. We go on, the first witness on the stand, during the middle of his testimony called by the plaintiff, there's an objection by Life Insurance Company of North America, Lina, to the introduction of testimony from that witness regarding ERISA and the summary plan description and ERISA documents and ERISA duties. That objection is overruled. Lina makes a motion to strike his testimony. Lina makes a motion for a mistrial, all on the grounds of ERISA preemption. And I just want to read to you one little bit from the statement of facts just to show you how far they went in asking for that. The quote that Lina stood and made in its motion for a mistrial was, and furthermore, we would urge the court that the provisions of the Employment Retirement Security Act of 1974 mandate the claims that the plaintiffs have brought that are in common law are preempted by federal law and so move for mistrial. I think that they raised the issue of ERISA preemption. I also want to go briefly to the idea of how ERISA originally came up and what the motion to strike that Lina filed at the beginning of this case was all about. The plaintiffs filed a number of petitions. They filed three petitions within 10 days of trial, within 10 days and closer to trial. Their third amended petition, actually there are two petitions that are labeled third amended. Their original third amended petition was filed, and Lina filed special exceptions. And those special exceptions were granted, and Lina said, tell me what kinds of claims you have for misrepresentation against me. Tell me what kinds of claims you have for failure to investigate or conduct a proper investigation under this claim. In response to that, the plaintiffs came back and they filed summary plan description claims saying this is where all of our claims come from. And in response to that amended petition, which was filed 10 days prior to trial, Lina responded and it raised its motion to strike. And I think if you read the motion to strike in that light and also the statement of facts, and I think you'll see that we have properly preserved this complaint.
Any questions?
Thank you. Thank you.
Unless the court has any questions on the contention that ERISA has to be pleaded or whether it was properly raised by Lina before the trial court, assuming it doesn't have to be pleaded, I'm going to give my time to my co-counsel.
Would you care to respond to the Hogan's last statement, the analogy regarding the product case in this case?
We pleaded a case for... Against Lina, we pleaded several cases. The ones that were eventually submitted to the jury were two causes of action. One, a plain old breach of an insurance cause of action brought under Texas law, and two, a cause of action which at the time of trial, this case was tried before the Arnold case, was a novel in Texas cause of action for bad faith by an insurance carrier. Those two causes of actions were the ones submitted to the jury. Lina never at any point during the trial said that those two causes of action were preempted by ERISA. The only thing they ever said was preempted by ERISA was another allegation we made, which was not submitted to the jury, on whether the summary plan description contained an accurate description of what was in fact contained in the insurance policy. We had pleaded a cause of action for common law fraud, saying the summary plan description is all messed up and doesn't misrepresents what's really covered in the insurance policy. They objected to that cause of action, and I've gone through in my appendix to my writ of error and just quoted the record for you repeatedly. That is the only thing Lina ever objected to in the trial, was that that specific contention was preempted by ERISA. It was never pleaded, it was never otherwise raised. They never made this contention. In fact, if you'd even suggested to the trial counsel for any party in this case that a plain old suit on a life insurance policy is somehow preempted by federal law, they all would have been astonished at the very thought at the time this was tried. The issue was never raised as to the causes of action that went to the jury until the Court of Appeals level. There are states, courts of last resort from other states that have said it is jurisdictional, which she cited in her brief. But it's interesting to note that every federal court to address this issue of federal law has said it's not jurisdictional, it goes to the choice of law governing the action, not the choice of forum. It has to be pleaded as an affirmative defense. The Fifth Circuit said that in a case just exactly on point. It was plain old suit for bad faith and on a life insurance policy that happened to be covered by an ERISA plan. The plaintiffs won at the trial. The defendant tried to go to the Fifth Circuit and say, wait a minute, ERISA preemption. The Fifth Circuit said, no, you can't do that. That is an affirmative defense that you had to raise in your pleadings. The same thing with the Texas State Courts of Appeals. The Dallas Court of Appeals, I don't think it's been cited to you, but Great North American Stationers v. Ball, which is cited in the Neely opinion, changed its mind and decided that ERISA was an affirmative defense. Once again, just in a plain old benefit suit. The Houston court first said it was jurisdictional in my case, and then recently they changed their mind, decided it was an affirmative defense. Anybody else have any further questions?
May I please the court, with the assistance of co-counsel, I do have some exhibits which are the same exhibits you have as our Appendix B to our brief. Let me just say, as a consumer lawyer that's been before this court several times, I don't pretend to tell this court how to interpret the laws with regard to this matter. I do hope to shed some light on these particular issues. To me, ERISA...
What is this, a departure from your prior practice?
Well, let me just say, Justice Gonzalez, that ERISA to me has always really meant every regulation issued since Adam. And I perhaps can't shed much light on it for you, but I do think that this court, like most juries, applies common sense whenever you look at any issue. And this court can obviously read and understand the English language. And that's all we're asking this court to do. You have to do nothing more than look to the statute passed by Congress, both the ERISA statute and the McCarran-Ferguson Act, and the statutes passed by the Texas Legislature, Article 21.21 and Article 1.13-1, which defines the business of insurance in this state. I submit to you, you don't have to read 20, 30, 40-page briefs or 20 or 30-page opinions to determine what the intent of Congress was. All you have to look is at the plain words of what's done here. This card that you see before you, which is in our appendix, is what Mr. Cathy was sold. And the word insurance is used on that card no less than six times. In fact, the printed card, which was printed by Dow and Metropolitan, two defendants in this case, say, I desire to be insured for the group medical insurance issued by the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. And ironically enough, at the summary judgment hearing and in all the papers that are before this court, the defendants take position that this is not insurance, that it's not an insured plan, that he did not get insurance here. If ever there was a misrepresentation that violates 1746B5 or 1746B12 of the DTPA or Section 4 and 5, 4.1 and 4.2 of the Article 2121 of the Insurance Code, this would be it. This is not just simply a claims handling case, as Mr. Harper would have you believe, although claims handling is involved. And claims handling is the business of insurance as defined by Section Article 1.13-1 of the Insurance Code. This is a misrepresentation, something that is clearly covered by Article 2121. The misrepresentation is right there on that form. And if you take the summary judgment proof as being true, which you're bound to do under our law, then there is a fact question with regard to these misrepresentations. Now, the common sense approach here, the big problem that Mr. Cathy had was that he paid his premiums through his employer. If he'd have bought this through his agent, or if someone had come to his house and sold him this policy, I wouldn't be here arguing before this court today, because all of the protections of state and federal law would apply to the policy that he thought he purchased. The only distinction is he paid it through his employer.
Counsel, you were given the opportunity to amend and make an ERISA claim. You chose not to.
Well, we did make the ERISA claim, Your Honor, in federal court against the plan.
But in this case, did the trial court give an opportunity to amend the pleadings?
They gave us an opportunity to amend to claim ERISA against these parties, which are not the plan.
Benefits under this insurance card. And you said no, under ERISA.
No, under ERISA, we were not suing under the plan these defendants. This was not a suit on the contract against these defendants. These defendants were not a party to that contract. The plan, as you understand, is a separate entity. And we did sue the plan in federal court under the ERISA statute. This is a suit in tort for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, Article 21.21, the DPPA, and 3.62. There is a distinction.
And the bottom line issue is whether or not all those causes of action
are preempted. Accepted. Yes, sir. Now, and I would hasten to point out, if I can get the last exhibit up there, that as I pointed out, the only difference here is that Mr. Cathy paid his premium through his employer rather than through an agent. Is that a distinction without a difference, or what? Why is it that people who buy their insurance separately from their employer have all the protections of state law, treble damages, unlimited punitive damages, all the other protections, but if you buy it through your employer, which most people do, you have none of those protections according to what the defendants would have you believe?
Because Congress has mandated that the risk that they're going to have an all-pervasive plan. That's their argument.
That is their argument, and it's an erroneous argument if anyone can read and understand the English language, as Justice Nallen did.
What about Justice O'Connor?
Well, Justice O'Connor did not have Article 21.21 before her, as did Judge Nallen, and neither did Justice O'Connor have the McCarran-Ferguson Act. In fact, in the Metropolitan versus Massachusetts case, the United States Supreme Court held that the McCarran-Ferguson Act is not preempted under 1144 subsection D. Well, Article 21.20.
Is the Nallen case on appeal?
No, Your Honor. It's fine. And the Nallen case is the only reported federal decision.
Just now, federal district court.
Yes, sir. Here. And
the case was not appealed?
It was not appealed.
The Fifth Circuit did not rule on it?
It did not rule on it. That case was not appealed. That is the only reported federal case involving Article 21.21. It holds Article 21.21 is not preempted by ERISA. Squarely, straight up. It took him less than a page to do it because I maintain he can read and understand the English language. Because all you have to do is look at the savings clause of ERISA. There's two parts of it. The savings clause, and here you have it right here, has subsection 2 and subsection D. First of all, any law that regulates the business of insurance is saved from preemption. Second of all, nothing in this subchapter shall be construed to alter, amend, modify, invalidate, impair, or supersede any law of the United States. That includes the McCarran-Ferguson Act. You cannot conclude, and of course, the United States Supreme Court has said McCarran-Ferguson is not preempted. If McCarran-Ferguson is not preempted, then Article 21.21 cannot be preempted because it is passed pursuant and at the invitation of Congress of the McCarran-Ferguson Act. That is our primary argument in this case. And all the cases to that effect are in accord. We would simply submit that the common sense ruling of this court should be look at the statutes, interpret what Congress has clearly said, and as Justice Cook said last week, under the Constitution of the State of Texas, the legislature has the exclusive power to enact laws. The sole role of the Supreme Court is to interpret them. The law has to be more than naked power. However, the majority of the court is using the power to interpret the law as a method to, in fact, make the law. If our constitutional form of government is to mean anything, then the separation of power should be respected. And he goes on to say that life is not death, black is not white, and in this case, we say that the savings clause is not a non-savings clause. I just didn't want that to be lost upon the court since it was only a week old. Thank you very much.
Judge Nallen's opinion attached to...
It's attached to our application for writ of error as Appendix A.
Oh. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments in the foregoing causes, all of which are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. That concludes the business of the court for the day, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, yeah.